guys, Jim Cox, and I'm here today with an interview with Richard Whiteford. We've known each other for a number of years. He's local to Pennsylvania, and he's a climate activist, does a lot of presentations around the themes that Al Gore originally brought up in Inconvenient Truth and has been talking about. And, you know, we recently reconnected, and I thought it was pretty timely given the flow of news with the environment and climate change and so forth. So, Richard, thanks for taking the time to chat today.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Awesome. So tell us a little bit about your background. Like, how did you get involved in talking about climate change? I mean, you've been doing this for a long time. I mean, how did you get involved in it?
Well, back prior to getting involved in climate change, my focus was on conservation biology, which has to do with endangered species and their habitat and that sort of thing. And I was involved with helping to preserve a prehistoric marshland in southeastern Pennsylvania. And I orchestrated a biological study on mammals. And we discovered that what used to be, that this marsh used to be their habitat, but the climate was changing and the marsh no longer was suitable for their habitat.
What year was this, Rich?
I started on climate change in 2007, so it was probably 2000, maybe 1999, 2000, back in that period of time. It's called the Great Marsh. At any rate, you know, I had been involved for years trying to protect habitat, to protect endangered and threatened species, and it dawned on me that if the habitat's changing, then we're wasting our time trying to protect something where the species will no longer be able to live. And I decided to change my focus from conservation biology to climate change.
Very cool. So how did you get connected to Al Gore? You've done a lot of presentations using the information and kind of his setup.
Yeah, I was working for Defenders of Wildlife at that time. I was a conservation organizer for the Northeast regional part of North America. And they sent all of us outreach people to his first training in Nashville. And, I took the training, and that really solidified my interest in climate change. And so I used his PowerPoint slides to do presentations. And it grew from there. I still work with him. I've been working with him for 15 years, helping him train other new recruits. But I have since become very familiar with certain climatologists like Michael Mann, Jim Hansen, Richard Alley, and a whole bunch of others. And so I have expanded my presentations to incorporate mostly the IPCC, Intergovernment Panel on Climate Change, information. And I keep it very current by gleaning stuff from their reports to keep mine state of the art, up to date. And as you mentioned, I've done, right now I'm at 340 presentations, and mostly universities and so forth. But I've been educating people on climate change since 2007.
Well, you know, based on the content that we have to work with here, I'm sure that this is going to be the first of quite a few talks that we're going to do on the podcast. But to start things out, you know, what is the state of the climate at this point? Like, we met each other, what, like 5 years ago, I think?
Yeah.
If not more. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, obviously things have changed dramatically, you know, in my point of view, in the last 3 years, if not back farther. You know, how have things changed?
Well, it's changing rapidly, number one, as you just mentioned. But one of the things about climate change is people confuse it with weather. Climate studies usually do things in 10-year increments because it takes a while to assess, you know, the data that comes in and so forth. So they don't look, climate scientists don't look at it in days, weeks, or months. It really is in decades. But we know, you know, the world's seven warmest years have been since 2014. So as you said, you know, it's speeding up. And the 10 warmest years occurred since 2005. And, you know, in 1901, temperatures in the U.S. increased. They were increasing about 0.16 degrees each decade. And beginning in the 70s, that rate jumped to a half a degree per decade. So,
wow.
Yeah, everything is going up. And so, you know, when I started, the first time when I trained with Al Gore, the CO2 was 382 parts per million. And for over 800,000 years, it hovered around 280 parts per million. So when I was working with Mr. Gore at that point, scientists were really freaked out about, you know, 382 parts per million. Oh my God, what are we going to do? Well, today it's 414 parts per million. Mm-hmm. So, and it goes up about two, on average, about two parts per million per year at this point in time, because we're dumping over 160 million tons of CO2 in the atmosphere at almost every year.
Well, not only is it going up, like you said, the two parts per million, but it's actually accelerating. Like, it's a little bit faster each year in terms of the rate of acceleration, wouldn't you say?
Yeah. You know, as I mentioned, since the 70s, it has jumped a half degree per decade. You know, it was 0.16 degrees prior to that. So yeah, it's rapidly accelerating, and we see it. You know, the more heat you get in the atmosphere, the more moisture it holds, and in certain parts of the planet, it sucks the moisture out of the ground and stores it in the atmosphere, and then it dumps all that water on different parts of the planets. And, mm-hmm. and so one area you have severe droughts, and the other area you've got severe flooding. And, you know, all you got to do today is watch the news and you can see the change in the climate.
So, you know, you mentioned IPCC, and they came out with a report recently, which was pretty alarming in terms of some of the language that it used. And, you know, usually it's a pretty staid comments in terms of how they present things. But I think a lot of people took this as a lot more alarmist, as it, you know, rightfully should be, I think. But, you know, what was in that most recent IPCC report that kind of changes things?
Well, I think the scariest thing, first of all, as you just said, they put a lot more urgency in the report. They used to be so incredibly conservative that they were afraid, you know, we were getting serious violent pushback from climate deniers. And so they were really treading lightly. But this report, and I'll quote this, it says, stabilizing the climate will require strong, immediate, rapid, and sustained large-scale reductions in greenhouse gas emissions, and getting to zero emissions, you know, by around 2050. And if we fail to do that, we're not, you know, we are going to go way beyond keeping the temperature at 1.5 or even 2 degrees Celsius. And so that's, you know, that shook me up to read that, because they've never been that emphatic before.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that I think is interesting is, you know, the weather impacts in a lot of ways, from what I understand, are nonlinear. Like, you know, to go from like a half degree increase to like 1.5 it's not just that the, or to go from a half a degree increase to like 1 degree, it's not that you're doubling in terms of the impact on a particular thing, but it's actually exponential, you know, in terms of the impact on, in terms of things like weather or like storms.
Or ice, you know, melt.
Ice melt, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, well, you know that,
a half a degree change. Okay, this is the mean global temperature of a degree, a change of a half degree in temperature from like, let's say 1.5 to 2, makes the difference between having a very sick coral reef ecosystem to having no coral reef ecosystem at all. That's what a half degree, you know, people think, oh, a half a grade, you know, degree. I get up in the morning and it's 65 out, and by 4 o'clock, it's, you know, 73 degrees or something like that. It's not like that. We're talking about the ground mean global temperature when we're talking about these temperatures. It's like the new bottom.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the hotter it gets, when we get up to 2 degrees Celsius, we're in really big shape, you know, bad shape. It's going to destroy agriculture. It's going to cause all kinds of health problems. I mean, you look at what happened this past summer when it was 121 degrees in British Columbia, Canada, and Anchorage.
Yeah.
And it was like over 200, I forget what the exact number was, but there was over 200 people that died from the heat. Mm-hmm. And when we get up to 2 degrees Celsius, that's, you know, that's over 4 degrees Fahrenheit as the average mean temperature on the planet. That is going to be devastating.
Yeah. One of the things that I think is interesting is as you go farther higher in the latitudes, like you go up to the Arctic, that two degrees is actually, the reason it's only 2 degrees is that the change at the Arctic is like 10 or 20 degrees. Yeah. I mean, it's a much larger number in terms of how much that swing is, obviously leading to the melt off of glaciers and ice cover.
Yep. Yeah, for sure.
So what, you know, one of the things that it feels like is happening, and you can kind of, I'm sure, talk about this, but like tipping points, there seem to be tipping points that we're getting to. One of the first of the main ones, I think, is just methane release. It seems like we're seeing much higher methane releases in some of the charts that I've seen online. And methane, while it's got a shorter lifespan than carbon dioxide, it actually is a much bigger influence in terms of raising temperatures, which goes, I think, a long way to explain why we see these kinds of huge temperature increases around the world. What do you see as far as tipping points?
Well, what you just hit on is the number one biggest concern, biggest tipping point right now. But the glacier and the ice sheets, you know, polar ice caps, that melt is, I would say, comes in number two. That in itself is causing the third tipping point, which is the slowing down of the North Atlantic Ocean current. And after that, I would put in forest diebacks and wildfires. I think those, and there are lots of smaller ones, but those are the big ones. They're the big Mojaves that, you know, and you know, when I started this back in 2007, all the scientists and Al Gore and everybody was saying, oh, around the year 2100, you know, you're going to see this stuff. Here we are now, 2021, and we're seeing it big time.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things that has really freaked out the IPCC, which is why they set out such a emphatic report this last time, because it's happening now at magnitudes that they didn't think would happen until the turn of the century.
Well, one of the things in a lot of these reports is they don't incorporate tipping points in terms of their calculations with a lot of the temperature changes. And so then when you do get tipping points occurring, you know, obviously it's throwing off their math. And, you know, I understand why they don't include tipping points, because you can, it's kind of unpredictable what that impact is going to have depending on when it occurs, and you don't know
what it's going to occur. There's a lot that needs to be learned about the tipping points. We have identified them. They know what the tipping points are, but it's, you know, you can't say when, you know, when it's going to tip the scales, and nobody knows what kind of effects. I mean, something like when all the ice melts and you raise sea level, you know, that's going to have a huge impact on humanity. On the other side is one of the tipping points is wildfires, which is putting a lot more CO2 in the atmosphere on top of what industry is doing. And, you know, some of these things very well will cause what you call a domino effect, and nobody can foresee or predict at this point how many dominoes are going to fall and what those dominoes are going to be. You know, this is uncharted territory in the scientific community, and scientists are scrambling to try to figure this stuff out.
Have there, you mentioned wildfires and forest fires as a tipping point. And I'm asked this question recently at the San Francisco Fed does they have people who come in and do economic models on climate change, and like once every 2 weeks. And I asked this question of somebody there, and they didn't have an answer. Are there people who are modeling the effect of forest fires destroying forests' ability to absorb carbon dioxide in modeling, like the loss of forest fires losing that ability to take carbon dioxide out of the atmosphere basically adds to increasing the amount of overall carbon dioxide that stays in the atmosphere? You know what I mean? Like, is there somebody looking at the math that those kinds of, like, when we have a year like this year with these huge fires and last year, and that's obviously going to accelerate the buildup of CO2?
Yeah, in fact, for the year, the figures aren't in for 2120 or 2021 right now, but the figures that came in for 2020 about the wildfires just in California now, where it burnt 3.4 million acres, that put 91 million tons of CO2 in the atmosphere, which was 25% more on top of their normal state emissions from transportation and everything else. So it added 25% more emissions to the atmosphere just last year. And, you know, you put a tackle on top of that, the Amazon rainforest put over 100 billion tons in CO2 in the atmosphere. And you're right, there are no trees anymore to suck that stuff in. And so, I don't know if you remember, like in the Al Gore presentation where he had that, looked like a sawtooth thing going up.
Yeah, the earth breathing.
Yeah, the air inhales and exhales. And so there's a whole lot more inhale and a whole lot less exhale happening these days for that reason. And another thing, I was in Arizona and we went through a wildfire area, and the nutrients in the soil were cooked. So this place isn't going to grow back for decades, you know, and so that has impeded growth, which would in turn suck up some of the CO2 in the atmosphere.
And the soil was cooked by the forest fire or by the heat overall?
Yeah, by the fire. This was the fire that was so intense that it just killed the soil. And that's happening in California. You know, I the last thing I did with Al Gore was back in April. I taught a group of people by Zoom up in British Columbia. And just last month, they started sending me all these pictures. One town on the other side of the mountain that they live on was called Lytton. That town burned to a crisp, totally gone, no town. You know, about 3 weeks later, they started sending me pictures that the fire started up again, came over the mountaintop and was coming down into their village. And, you know, you could see it looked like yellow fog just from the smoke. Unfortunately, they didn't lose their town, but, you know, that whole area up there is no better off than parts of California. Hmm. And this is areas, you know, all these areas are areas that will not suck up CO2 out of the atmosphere until there's time for regrowth.
Hmm. So, you know, in the past couple of years that we've known each other, and has anything really positive been done to address climate change? Like, are there really things that we can say, you know, this has made a difference in a positive way?
Quite a few things, actually. Unfortunately, not big enough, fast enough. But I mean, you know, just what, yesterday or the day before, Ford Motor Company's announced that they were building four new auto plants in this country strictly for developing electric vehicles. And you know, Volkswagen, Mercedes-Benz, BMW, and Hyundai are some of the other companies that are doing it, and of course, Tesla. And so there's a big move on with that. If President Biden actually gets his package, which is really up in the air right now, but if he should do that, I think some of the incentives and some of the money out of that would go, you know, it would help out greatly in getting more solar, more wind, and that kind of stuff out there. You know, he's already trying to get them to build wind farms out in the Atlantic Ocean off the coast. And, you know, solar is making great strides. And you know, I got this report from the IEA, the International Energy Agency, that said that global electric generation rose from 27 to 29% in 2020. And overall, in the last 10 years, renewables in the power sector have been growing. And it said they've been growing by an average of 10% each year. And it said, despite the shock from the pandemic, renewables accelerated in 2020 with a 50% increase in their contribution to lowering emissions. So, you know, that's something that's going on right now. And, you know, there's things like the Sierra Club. The Sierra Club has a thing called Ready for 100. And I think there's like 300 cities in the United States who have signed an agreement to get to zero emissions by 2050. And, you know, they're really on board to do that. The Sierra Club is actually monitoring these cities and you know, trying to keep them on track so that they achieve this goal and so forth. And there's an organization called the Regional Greenhouse Gas Initiative that I think there are 11 states in it now. We're trying to get Pennsylvania in it, and we're getting a lot of pushback from all the legislators in the coal region. But they have cut a lot of CO2. The ones that are existing right now, I think they've cut, lowered their CO2 emissions by 28%. And they are trying to cut it an additional on top of the 28. They're trying to cut their emissions by 30% by 2030, by the year 2030. And if they achieve that, they will actually help the state, the states in that region, help the United States meet their Paris Agreement commitments. So those type of things are happening, and they're big, you know. And then you have people putting solar on their houses and buying the EV cars and doing a whole lot of things on an individual level that is contributing to, you know, trying to get the CO2 emissions down. The big problem is, like I said earlier, we're putting about 160 million tons of CO2 up there every year. And we got to, you know, wean ourselves off of fossil fuels fast, as the IPCC just said. We got to bring this down real fast, as quickly as we can. It's probably going to be a little painful, but you know, do we want to survive?
And that actually leads into one of the things that I is occurring currently is, which I think is interesting, in England, they have a energy crisis of their own that they're going through. Combination of different factors contributed to it. Winds not blowing as they were supposed to. A cable from Europe supplying energy disrupted, and natural gas prices at the end of the day going through the roof. But one of the things that how this links back to this need to transition, though, is when you get to that times like that where you have an energy crunch and then you have like a reaction against renewables saying, you know, we need more natural gas, we need more fossil fuels to, it's like taking away the addiction from the addict and the addict not wanting to feel the pain, like you said. So it seems like how do we get through that kind of addictive pain? Because it seems like that would create a lot of social, political unrest.
Well, I love the way you put that. That was a great analogy. That's, you know, that's the million-dollar question. I mean, that's what I deal with here in Pennsylvania. You know, I've attended a lot of the Environmental Energy Committee meetings in Harrisburg, and they bring in, you know, they right now the Republicans are in control of the legislature, and so the leaders of the committees are Republicans, and it just so happens that the Republicans that got the leadership on the E&E committees are all from the fossil parts of the state. And three times this past year, they brought in three of the most notorious climate deniers on the planet. You know, I had three scientists in those hearings from the IPCC. They gave Rick Morano and David LeGates and these climate deniers the floor. And at the very end of the hearing, this happened in three different hearings, at the very end of these hearings, they allowed a IPCC scientist to make a statement. And then I don't know if I should name names here, but the chair of this House committee talked through the time allotted for this IPCC scientist to make a statement. And he finally let her have the floor, and she started to open her mouth, and he pounded the gavel and said, this meeting's over, this hearing's over, and they all got up and walked out. And so there is the type of opposition that we are dealing with. It all comes down to money. It all comes down to, you know, these industries are, they're going to, you know, the coal industry in Pennsylvania is already belly up, and they keep blaming it on us, you know, climate people. And it has nothing to do with us. It has everything to do with finance. Natural gas came along and it just bumped them right out of existence. And, you know, they keep trying to bring it back. You know, President Trump came up to Pennsylvania three times, and while he was trying to, reinstate coal, and they were trying to, we got a whole bunch of coal-fired power plants here in the state converted to natural gas, which still is a greenhouse gas, but it's a whole lot less dangerous than coal. And so they were actually introducing legislation to reinstate them as coal-burning power plants. And, you know, I wrote an op-ed piece about it that got published in the Pittsburgh paper, which was good because that's where they read that paper. But it's like, instead of beating a dead horse, why don't you invite, you know, clean energy and progressive businesses into your districts, because this ain't ever coming back.
Well, that's the reality of sunken assets, right? The fact that these assets at this point effectively have no value. So they're trying to assign a value to something that is valueless.
Stranded assets, you know, it's just, but you know, it makes the point that you brought up. It's like, these people are going to go down with the ship.
Yeah.
When I get to say something in these hearings, I ask them, you know, do you have children? You know, what is this planet going to be like when they're adults? If you keep us burning fossil fuels, that it's going to destroy life on this planet as we know it. And you know, don't you care about your kids and your grandkids? It just befuddles my mind. But money talks, you know. Money talks.
Well, how do they respond? You know, basically, we don't believe in your type of science. Is that basically the comeback, or?
Oh yeah, that's it. In a nutshell, yeah. Oh, well, you know, we have our science, you know, we have alternate science, you know. It's like, you know. And
I have a D&D book from when I was a kid, too, but that doesn't make it reality.
Well, you know, I have had people interrupt me when I'm doing my PowerPoint presentations. And I ask them, I say, well, you know, bring your science up here. I'm going to put it on the podium. I want to see it. Yeah. I said, I've been asking for this for 15 years, and I've not even gotten a little post-it stamp with something written on it. You know, where is your science? You know, except for, I think it was in 2019 or somewhere back there on Earth Day, the Heartland Institute had put together this whole mailing package. And they had this book in there called The Mad, Mad, Mad World of Climate Change or something like that. And they had a list, you know, the IPCC has about, you know, over 2000 scientists. It fluctuates back and forth, but over 2000. So they came up with this list of people that they put in this package who are their scientists, who say that what the IPCC is saying is bunk. And they were banking on nobody ever reading it. But you know, one of the names in there was Annette Funicello, who used to be on Mickey Mouse Club. And a whole bunch of, you know, people like that. To just
talk about a Mickey Mouse organization.
Yeah. And even Fred Singer, you know, there for a while, he was their big guy, you know. And Fred Singer, he was a very accomplished scientist at one point. But he was a nuclear scientist. He actually worked with Al Teller developing the atomic bomb. But he was not a meteorologist. He was not a climatologist. And frankly, over the years, he started getting a little bit goofy upstairs. Finally, I think they gave up on him because he got to a point where, he's not too, he doesn't make a lot of sense when he talks anymore at all. But they just hang on things like that. And they really rely on their ideological group to just accept whatever they say. You know, that sort of seems the political play these days is, you know, if I say it, you just believe it, you know, and just take my word for it. And so it's really tough to deal with that.
Yeah. If just to plug a book that I'm currently reading for a class I'm taking, there's a book titled White Skin, Black Fuel. And it outlines the connections between conservatism and the fossil fuel industry, and especially racism. And, you know, it really goes to connecting those dots and there's such a wall there between that, like you experienced, it seems like can never be overcome. It's like, it's just a matter of, we have to build up enough numbers to be able to push through that wall, regardless of what they throw up, because it's never going to be a matter of coming to common ground, which, you know, would be, I would say, the way a democracy should work. But, you know, there's literally no common ground because they're not based in reality. They're based in delusion, their own delusion.
Yeah. And that's humanity. How do you deal with human beings like that? I mean, I have extended relatives that you know, I dread going to, you know, a family reunion or anything.
Yeah.
Because all I end up doing is defending myself, you know, even though I don't even say anything or bring anything up. They know what I do. And they all have the same talking points. It's like the Heartland yep. Institute tells them what to say, and so they go say it. They don't even investigate to find out whether it might be true or not. They just say it because, you know, I pledge allegiance to my ideology.
Ideology, exactly, yep. Exactly. Yep. You mentioned before and with talking about coal and natural gas, the role of finance. What's the impact of divestment from fossil fuels, do you think? Or has divestment over the past couple of years had an impact?
I think it is a movement in progress. What I can tell you is back in December of 2020, this was last December. Well, actually, this December hasn't gotten here yet. But last December, the New York City dropped $226 billion of fossil assets from their pension fund. Yeah, that's got to hurt a little bit, you know. Mm-hmm. And I got, this was from Wikipedia, but I got, as of 2021, 1,300 institutions worth $14.6 trillion have been divested of fossil holdings. And so there's a movement on. I know, I live in outside the Philadelphia area. I know there's a couple banks down here that got a lot of pressure put on them to drop their holdings. And I understand that BlackRock, which is one of the biggest financial institutions, is talking about it and divesting from fossil fuels. If they do that, I think that'll put it in the stranded asset category quite rapidly, but it's got momentum. There's a movement.
There was a talk I heard on Bloomberg yesterday. They were interviewing the head of risk management for AXA in Europe, and one of the things that he said was interesting was that they were not going to insure coal, but they were going to insure companies that were helping in the transition, which, you know, not insuring coal is kind of low-hanging fruit. You know, it's dead.
Right.
But still going ahead and insuring companies like Shell or Total and so forth that are quote-unquote in transition and yet still fundamentally contributing to the problem of carbon dioxide increase isn't necessarily, you know, doing the right thing either. You know, it's a matter of degrees for some for I think a lot of institutions. I mean, with the work that I do, you know, I have no fossil fuels, no banks, you know, and that's
right.
That's how we deal with the issue. And I think it's the right one, but you know, there's a lot of greenwashing that's going on too, it seems.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I would love them to define the transition.
Yeah. What does that look like?
Yeah, according to the IEA, they got the accelerator down on the floor, heading for drilling more and extracting more stuff. So yeah, I'd be interested in seeing that what the transition is there. You know.
So what? So for you, what does a concept like degrowth look like? If we're not going to have a growth-oriented economy and we're going to go to degrowth in order to you know, kind of back away from the energy expenditure that we're currently engaged in that's killing the planet, what does that look like to be degrowth instead of kind of hypergrowth?
I wonder, you know, I think that it's inevitable that there's going to be some degrowth, but I think that that is one of those scare words that, you know, the other side likes to use. Are you familiar with, Kate Raworth? Kate Raworth, are you familiar with Kate?
No.
I heard a interview with her on NPR. Being the liberal that I am, but she has a book called Donut Economics, and it really seems to have gotten some traction, because since I heard that interview, I've heard a whole bunch of talk about her on other radio and TV programs, TV news, and everything else. It's called Donut Economics, and it proposes having a circular economic model as opposed to what we have now, which is linear. It's just more, faster, bigger. And she said that she wants to redesign money, finance, and business to be service to the people as opposed to service to, you know, the quarterly report or, you know, the bottom line kind of a thing, and create economies that are regenerative and also distributive by design, rather than being having a throwaway economy and that kind of stuff. And I think that, you know, I think it was even Paul Krugman who had mentioned her in one of the New York Times articles or something. But I think people realize that capitalism is unsustainable. I've known that, you know, for a long time. I got thrown out of an economics class at Westchester University for disagreeing with them. That was a long time ago. But anyway,
you should go back.
Yeah, I should. I don't. That professor's probably dead by now. But anyway, I think that we need to rethink it. And I also think, I think a lot of people support this, that there are already solutions right now to help cut CO2 from the atmosphere that also would create new economies in rust belt areas and things like that. Like there needs to be some probably government coordination behind it. But, you know, I wrote a piece, I sent this thing to the New York Times the other day. They had an article about Ford Motor building these four assembly plants here in this country for electric vehicles. I just said to them, hopefully Ford will take a look and locate these plants in places where fossil workers are being replaced. You know, rather than put them out of work, put a factory there and give them a safer job, a cleaner job, and a better paying job. And I think that if you can do that kind of a walk, we can walk ourselves into a new economy and new economic structure without there being too much pain. There's going to be some pain because, everything, our whole economic structure is based on fossil fuels right now.
If we build a couple of windmill factories in South Dakota where all the fracking is occurring, you know, replace the frack wells with wind turbines instead.
Yeah. Another thing are batteries. You know, batteries are becoming one of the most important needed technologies on the planet. Put factories in places like that where you make batteries, where you make chips, microchips, and that kind of thing. It takes innovation rather than people that say you can't do it or you're going to kill the economy and all that stuff. Get off your butts and go, you know, get into something new, because the old is going down the toilet. It's not going to be there anymore, whether you like it or not.
Mm-hmm. No doubt. So, you know, there's a lot of you know, among a lot of people in, I think in terms of my circle, there's a lot of climate grief, you know? Like, how do you deal with kind of the course that we're on and dealing with kind of the, onerous nature of it? Like, how do you overcome that sense of grief?
Well, I if I had enough money, I'd go to a therapist.
I don't think they could help you, though.
I think you should ask my wife that question, not me. It's tough. It is very tough. Particularly, what makes it discouraging and tough is just watching the momentum of the ideology that denies it, and you know, they are the naysayers, and realizing they have no idea what they're talking about, yet so many people believe them and follow in lockstep with them. I think that depresses me more than anything, because if we had people understand, you know, what's going on, and understand that there's only one way out of this, and that's to create new economies and see it from that positive thing, we'd be making progress. But there are just so many people. I have neighbors like that, and that's what really gets me down. It's like you can't get people to hear what's available, hear the options. They shut down, they close their minds, and I don't know how to deal with that.
so how do you fill up your pod in the morning? Like, how do you not let that overcome you?
I live in a house with a combined family. My one son and his wife and our 5-year-old grandson live with us. My wife and I have the in-law suite. And he's my battery charger, my 5-year-old. I look at him and I just can't allow him to have a really messed up future. And I'm only one person. There's only so much I can do. But I'm just going to keep fighting until I'm dead, because it's for him.
Exactly. That's exactly it. That's awesome. If people want to learn more about the work that you do, how can they reach out to you, Rich?
The best thing is to Google me, I guess. I have a blog. I think it's on my signature in my email signature. Why, mm-hmm. Save Biosphere, SAVEBiosphere.wordpress.com. If you go to that, that's my internet page, and I've got all photographs, articles, newspaper articles, and all that kind of stuff on there. And so that would be a good way, the best way probably. And then my email address is savebiosphere3@gmail.com.
Awesome. And that's, I think, we'll have to continue this in a couple of months. But I appreciate your taking the time to chat today and share your insight and experience.
Thanks so much for having me on. I really appreciate it. I did check out your blog, and I'm very impressed with it. And I feel honored to be interviewed. Thank you.
No, thank you. I'll talk to you soon. Thanks, Rich.
Bye now.